Hello and welcome back to season 3 of Listening to the Dead.
Hello and welcome to season 3, episode 4. We're back recording down the line today, so please forgive us if the sound quality is a little variable or for any background noises that may appear, like Linda's neighbour and his infamous leaf blower. So, today we're looking at the role of DNA screening and analysis and how it influenced the cases of Colin Pitchfork and Colette Aram. These are two cases that illustrate how remarkably rapidly the application and techniques of DNA screening and analysis changed in the few years from its first use in the late 1980s. We start with the case of Colin Pitchfork. The investigation into the murderer Colin Pitchfork is famous in forensic circles for being the first case where DNA mass screening was used to identify a suspect. The story begins with two brutal rapes and murders in 1983 and 86. At the time, the police could only use blood analysis to identify that both murders had been committed by somebody with blood type A. The police first arrested Richard Buckland, a local 17-year-old with learning difficulties who had seemed to have some knowledge of one of the crime scenes. During cross-examination, he then admitted to one of the murders but denied the other. Then came an experiment by Alec Jeffries at the University of Leicester alongside the Forensic Science Service, the FSS, which used DNA for the first time to establish that both girls were killed by the same man and it wasn't Buckland. Buckland then became the first person to have his innocence established by DNA fingerprinting. The police and the FSS then undertook an investigation in which more than 5,500 local men were asked to volunteer blood or saliva samples. They found no matches. But then a colleague of Pitchfork's admitted that he had given a sample pretending to be Pitchfork, and Pitchfork was arrested and convicted. Our guest today is Dr. Tim Clayton, who joined the FSS in 1990, shortly after the case. Welcome, Tim. I suppose the first question to you then is, what are your memories of this case and of joining the FSS at such an exciting time?
Well, yes, I joined the Forensic Science Service in 1990, and that was really just after the conclusion of the Colin Pitchfork matter. By that time, we were beginning to routinely use Alec's technique, which was known by four letters, RFLP, Restriction Fragment Length Polymorphism. Horrible mouthful there. But when I joined, I had to do a 12-month rotation through the DNA unit and obviously learned firsthand how to use that technique. The Narborough Enderby case, as it's known in the circles, was infamous and famous. You mentioned a couple of firsts. It's the first time DNA had been used in a criminal case. It'd be the first time anybody had been exonerated by DNA, because Buckland was actually exonerated despite his confessions. And it was the first time we'd ever done a mass screen, sometimes called a blooding. It was made famous in a book by Joe Wombo called The Blooding. It was the first time we'd ever used a special technique to separate semen from other types of body fluids, so something we call a preferential extraction. So it's the first application of a brand new technique to separate sperm for DNA analysis on its own. And obviously, when Pitchfork was convicted in 87, it was the first ever DNA-based conviction. So, yeah, there you have it, five firsts, all within basically a 1.5-2 year period.
Well, it must have been a really exciting time to join then. I mean, like, you know, DNA and genetics must have been riding high. I mean, it was a great time to be there.
Yes.
But, I mean, do you remember learning about the technique for the first time and thinking, wow, or was it just something that had been coming for a while?
Well, the technical aspects I'd already done through my PhD. I'd already been using most of the molecular biology techniques that Alec had used at Leicester. They weren't new. What was new was the idea that all cells contain DNA. If you can extract DNA from those cells and use these hypervariable sites, you could tell the difference between practically everybody on the planet. And that was the genius idea. And that's rightly why he was recognised as being, you know, the grandfather of DNA analysis, and, you know, he deserved all the accolades he could get for that idea. But I will say this, the technique didn't work very well. And this isn't a commonly known story, but there were many, many problems with it, practical problems with it. And we'll get onto that, I'm sure, later on. But it was good enough to do the first DNA cases, but it quickly became evident that we couldn't continue using it in the form that Alec had conceived it of. And then after that, mainly under the direction of Professor Peter Gill, who's the unwritten hero, I guess, for modern DNA analysis, we effectively stopped using Alec's technique and completely re-engineered and started again in a completely different way. And it's that technique that has become the mainstay worldwide of all forensic DNA analysis. We were about to go another quantum leap now in 2021-22 into what I call forensic genomics, but the birth of forensic genetics really happened in the mid-80s.
Okay. Well, as you say, we're going to come back and analyse where you went from there, from that embryonic point. But I just wanted to peel off and talk to you, Linda, because as Tim was joining the FSS and all of this was happening, you were busy writing Prime Suspect. And as listeners of the podcast will know, Prime Suspect was the first time that DNA was used on a fictional TV program. And I just really want to ask what your memories of that were. How did you come across DNA? Because we're talking 3 years after Alec Jeffries and that breakthrough with the Pitchfork case. So it's very quick to be using it in fiction. Where did you come across it and how did you research it?
Basically, most of whatever happened in Prime Suspect, I was led by the Metropolitan Police and particularly the DCI, Jackie Moulton. And she threw it into, I'm writing away, and she said, you know, if your killer has been arrested and charged with a sexual case previously, his sperm will be on record and that could actually give you DNA. And I said, well, what's DNA? And she went into this sort of explanation that went right over my head. But she said they could actually match in the cadaver that they find if it has semen and matches the one they have on record, it will prove that he did have a contact with that murder victim. And so I went through all that and then passing it backward and forward and saying, is this the correct way they would say it? Would this excitement be generated by that? And they said, yeah, because it's not even really in full use at the moment. And they brought up the Pitchfork case. And so that was why I really went as fast as I could to get that into the plot. And it was a very, very exciting moment because it also showed you that even the Detective Chief Inspector Jane Tennyson was unsure of that scientific breakthrough. And it did take a long time for many, many police officers to actually get into the knowledge of how important it was.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's one for you, Kaz. I mean,
yeah.
Do you remember how it was viewed? Do you remember, is there any cynicism towards this? Any caution about using it?
I remember when it was kind of like first came to be known because it wasn't the Met who dealt with the Pitchfork case, but there was this new sort of technology, but we didn't really know a lot about it other than what the scientists might have told us. We were led to believe, you know, that I think it was, then Tim might could correct me wrong, is, you know, you needed a blood sample the size of like a 10p piece if it was blood you were looking at. And the first case that I can remember personally being involved in London was the Southwark rapist in about 1987. But that was the first case I can remember. But there was a big, you know, like, oh, is this going to solve everything? But I think as time went by as well, with the scientists being able to say to police, look, there could be reasons that the DNA might be on somebody. You know, the DNA isn't conclusive alone, whereas I think the police sort of felt, oh, that's it. This is going to crack our case for us. We've got him. But there was a lot more, you know, actual groundwork investigation that needed to be done around his alibi. Had he been in the house before, etc.
Yeah. So, I mean, with DNA, do you remember getting a sort of educated? Do you remember getting training in it? Was it something that was actively pursued by the Met?
To be honest, no, I don't think so at all. I mean, if I'm honest, even in training school, when I joined, I think you had about 1 hour of forensic awareness, which was basically, you know, don't touch things. And even as time went on, just before I was retiring, there was hardly any training about forensic awareness. The big change for me in learning about science was when I became a CSI and I joined the Chartered Society of Forensic Sciences, where I met, you know, listen to scientists speak and listen to lectures. And the police, they didn't do that. I felt personally they should have done, because they need to know. If you don't understand the science, how do you know how it applies to your investigation?
Yeah, I can see Tim smiling and nodding there. This is familiar to you?
Yes, very much so. There was a, when I joined it, even into the mid-90s, there was a, I sympathise with Cass because there was very little rank and file knowledge. You might have a few SIOs, senior investigating officers, who might have an awareness. There was a heavy reliance on the crime scene examiners to do the sciencey bit of policing, but not very much awareness about the opportunity. So, I mean, I remember with the Forensic Science Service in the mid 90s, we started then making training videos called First Officer Attending, and then speaking, and then there was a much greater emphasis through the 90s on bringing up the forensic capabilities and awareness for rank and file officers, because most officers attending a crime scene are rank and file officers. All the bigwigs don't parachute in until much later on. So your first people on scene are the people who have to know what to do, how to secure the scene, how to set a perimeter up, how not to interfere with things, how to what order, who to call, when to call, how to do it. And I mean, Cass will know this, you've got a golden opportunity, a window opportunity, forensically speaking, that can be degraded very, very quickly. So unless you can press the button and get all the right people in immediately, your forensic opportunities, especially if you've got outdoor scenes and things like that, those opportunities are starting to disappear all the time. And moreover, if you've got people away from the scene, protagonists who are leaving, we're losing evidence all the time. The longer it takes to get to those people, the less likely you are to recover trace evidence, particulate evidence, DNA evidence. And so as hours turn into days and days turn into weeks, your forensic opportunities degrade very, very rapidly.
Just interesting, as an aside to that about SIOs, that first case in London, the Southwark rapist, when they've got the DNA, they, you know, that it was like, oh well, now we need to find the man. But because it was something big and new, the fatal mistake that was made was the police going on television and press and saying, we've got this man's DNA. If we find you, we'll get the match, etc. So, well, guess what? Every scene he went to after that, he never left a cigarette end, because he used to sit and smoke with his victims before he assaulted and raped them. Never found another cigarette end after that. So, you know, it was this wonderful new thing, and let's tell the world what we've got. Well, actually, you know, that led to problems. And it wasn't until 20 years later he was caught.
Someone was getting educated about DNA then.
Tim, you know, when you're watching any of the crime dramas we have now, which we have a plethora, they refer constantly to the DNA. And I just would like to know, I mean, we obviously know semen, blood, saliva. What other areas can you get DNA from?
Well, I hope you've had your breakfast, so I'll go into it. So basically any biological material contains DNA. It's just the level that it contains. So the quote-unquote good sources of DNA is whole blood. Whole blood mainly contains red blood cells, which are one of the weird things in the body that don't contain DNA. Red blood cells are anucleate. They don't have any DNA. But also the plasma and the white cells are full of DNA. So whole blood, lots of DNA. Saliva doesn't contain DNA, but it has suspended in it cells from the lining of the mouth, and it's a reasonably good source of DNA. Semen, its only job is to carry packets of DNA to the egg to fertilize it. And so that's chock full of DNA. So those are the three big ones. But let's think about the other biological fluids. Well, whenever you touch anything, you've got a cup of coffee there. Every time you pick up that cup of coffee, there are skin cells sloughing off from the surface of your skin, and also you're depositing oils and sweat from glands, which also contain traces of DNA. So that feces will contain DNA that's sloughing off your gut. You can have hair, even dead hair and live hair. Pulled hair tends to be pulled from the scalp, and they contain little pockets of tissue at the end of the hair, what are called follicular tags. They contain it. So pulled hair is a great source of DNA. But even fallen dead hair, what we call telogen hair, has a greasy coating on the outside of the hair, and trapped and stuck in that are lots of cells from the scalp. So even fallen hairs can have DNA on it. Just about anything, if we have a body identification, we can use any organ, any muscle, any shards of skin. If it's biological material, it's made usually of cells, or it's got cells in it. Even if it's a secretion, it's got cells in it. And with the exception of red blood cells, all cells contain DNA. And therefore, if you leave me a sample of your cells, I have a sample of your DNA. The only question is how much of it. Some bodily fluids have got inherently much less. Vomit, for instance, contains DNA because as you regurgitate it from your stomach, there are all cells lining your esophagus, and also you're swallowing back saliva into your stomach the whole of the time. So I've successfully tested vomit, but the amount of DNA is low. So we have a spectrum of yield, as we call it, but basically any biological material will do. If we can find it, we can test it.
Brilliant.
You can hear Linda writing the next novel. Tim, if we go back to the Pitchfork case, you spoke there about the limitations of the technique, the original technique pioneered by Alec Jeffries. How quickly did the limitations become apparent, and what did you begin to do about them?
The first problem, Cass has already alluded to it, which was sensitivity. So the RFLP technique needed significant amounts of deposition at the scene. So I think, a decent sized blood stain, quite a decent ejaculative semen. And so certain bodily fluids and biological material weren't amenable to this analysis because they just didn't have the yield. There wasn't enough DNA. And also you then became very, very dependent on the amount of material left by the offender. And so its lack of sensitivity in terms of how much DNA it required was its major downfall. The next problem we got was the speed at which it was done. The RFLP technique required radioactive probes to be done, electrophoresis, long-term autoradiograph exposure, and it could take several weeks to develop a DNA profile. And obviously, I was talking about the forensic window. This is far too long for real-time investigation. And so the speed, the slowness of the technique was another major, major handicap. And then there are some other things like working with radioactivity. Not good. You have to have a radioactive license. Have probes made. The probes degrade over time. They lose their radioactivity. And so just working with radioactivity full stop is a bit of a negative. And then the other big thing was something called degradation. Once the DNA's left the body, once the cells have been deposited, the material's been deposited, the DNA chain begins to break into pieces. And this is what we call DNA degradation. It deteriorates. And the RFLP technique couldn't really cope with deteriorated DNA. So if the DNA was degraded, you just got nothing. And so these were the big drawbacks. And at the time, other techniques were emerging, which would get around some of these problems. And so a research group was formed at the Forensic Science Service, led by Dave Werritt and Peter Gill. Peter Gill had worked with Alec to develop the preferential DNA extraction technique. And he got a group of people together, including myself and several colleagues who'd got experience of DNA research. And we basically went back to the drawing board. We scrapped Alec's technique, kept the idea, and completely reinvented it. And then came the second generation of DNA profiling, which is known as STR, stands for short tandem repeat, STR DNA profiling. And it was that technique that then enabled the production of what are called DNA databases, mass collections of DNA. And it was those that changed the face of DNA, because it went from being a reactive technique. In other words, in the Linda Mandorn Ashworth case, the police had to come up with the man. They had to know who he was to put to take a sample from him, to test it, to compare. But once you have a DNA database, people can be on the database, and you can then search that database to develop who suspects might be. And just about every country in the world now is using STR technology and has based their DNA databases, national DNA databases, around that technology. And that started 94, 95. And now, in 2021, the UK National DNA Database from 95 is still up and running. It's still using that technology. And, there's about 4.5 million people on there.
Are there ethical challenges to the DNA database when it started up?
Yes, I mean, the DNA database idea escaped. It wasn't discussed. We were having discussions with the then politicians who were in power. I think it was a Tory government at the time. And I think the Home Secretary was Michael Howard. And we'd mentioned the possibility through policing that there was a way of doing proactive DNA profiling by taking DNA from suspects on their arrest and not adding them to the national DNA database, and that we could potentially have an investigative database that the police could use. And then all of a sudden, really, without almost no consultation whatsoever, Michael Howard announced it at the Tory party conference that there would be a national DNA database. We were off and running before really much of the ethics of whether it was right to take people's DNA proactively was ever discussed. It was technically possible, and we just went ahead and did it.
Mm. I mean, it seems like a massive change, Kaz. I mean, I suppose the success of the Colin Pitchfork case was almost in proving the innocence of Buckland, because there was no DNA database. It wasn't about proactively finding the killer. It was about proving the innocence of one person, and then the Pitchfork mass swab happened. So, do you remember? I mean, this DNA database must have changed everything for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was like Tim was saying, though, like, suspects, you were getting them left, right and centre. I mean, even before the database, I mean, even going, if you went back to, like, the Southwark Rapists, we would go out at night in that area doing patrols, and anyone we weren't happy with who we stopped, who didn't give us the right answers, would be asked to give a voluntary DNA. If they didn't, they were simply arrested on suspicion, and that DNA would be taken by force if necessary, because that's the way it was then, and that's how it felt you were going to catch the person. But then with the database, of course, one of the problems is that when it all first started was, would that person be on the database because of the backlog, or how long is it going to take to do your raise a profile of your suspect to run it on the database? And of course, you're constrained by time restrictions about how long you can hold somebody in custody. So you might have to release that person. Of course, if they know that it's going to come back as a match, that they've had it, they could well, disappear off the face of the earth, so to speak, abroad, or Spain being one of the old favourites. So that there were problems around it. I mean, I think the quickest I know of that there was ever a turnaround was in the Night Stalker case, but Tim might know about, which I think was done in about 12 hours or so.
Yep, that's correct. So Operation Minstead. At the time, there was a technical lower limit that you could get to of about 12 hours. But if the sample was taken, was blues and twos, as we used to call it, on a bike to the lab, we're all sat waiting for it. We could do that, and assuming all the procedures work first time, we could get it from sample to DNA profile and then make the match or not, as the case may be, within about, well, eventually we got it down to 9 hours, but it was 9 or 12 hours. And as Cass says, the corollary of having to release somebody because the pace clock's gone means two things. One is they could, e.g. flee the jurisdiction. Two is, and it has happened before, they might choose to go on some kind of rampage or something like that, knowing that the sands of time are running out. So these days, forensics and specifically DNA has had to move to doing real-time work, real-time downloads of phones, real-time fingerprint work, real-time DNA to make sure that we can meet the custody time limits and clocks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk here about, you know, you moving on from that original work and you've developed these new techniques. How much did you then tweak those techniques all the time to move them on? I was just wondering about how much you could tell from DNA. Like in the early days, you might be able to tell some simple stuff. Did it get more complicated until a profile became more complete?
That's right. So initially, the DNA technology field has never stopped moving. It's moved at an astonishing rate, even since 1995. And the rate of change is still accelerating. So we are now moving into a new era of forensics called forensic genomics. In other words, we can tell things about your physical appearance, determine your chronological age from DNA, your biogeographical ancestry, as well as differentiate practically everybody on the planet. We can even now differentiate between identical twins using DNA. Now we've moved into the genomics era. And so I still have to work extremely hard in my reading and study to keep pace. Every time the journals come out, there's a new technique, there's a new movement. And frankly, the rate of change is still accelerating rather than slowing down, which in forensic terms, because most forensic techniques move at a glacially slow pace, but DNA is the polar opposite. It's moving at an astonishing rate. And also then it's engaging ethical and other legal debates about where the edges of permissibility stop and start.
Yeah.
Just about ethics, really. So they can take your blood sample or your samples for a speeding ticket of 38 miles an hour in a built-up area, there it's 20, and you are immediately on record, which I find in some ways very good, yes. The simplicity of it, but wouldn't or couldn't it be something that was automatically done at the birth of every child?
You're hitting on the kind of ethical debate. So you can go from it's not right to have anybody on a DNA database because it's an infringement of their genetic privacy, right the way through to let's get everybody done and then we'll know immediately when we get a DNA who that is. So you've got the polar extremes there of approaches. So what law enforcement has decided is to take a middle ground. So initially we began where if you were arrested for a recordable offence, you would have mouth swabs, but what we call buccal scrapes, taken from you. Okay, but you would then be kept on the system until you effectively died. That was reined back. So what happens now is you, after your arrest, your DNA is taken. But if you are then acquitted or not charged or the Crown doesn't proceed against you in any way, then your DNA is removed from the database. So it's not on there in perpetuity. But if you're convicted, it is. Now, on the other extreme of obviously having nobody on and not keeping anybody, then what you are really doing is handicapping law enforcement. We've got a very, very powerful tool. And is it right that a serial rapist could be caught for one rape but then not linked to other rapes because his DNA doesn't go on the database and doesn't make the connection with the other crimes? And also, if we go to the other extreme, let's think about how am I going to do everybody? So we need to catch every child who's born. People are dying all the time. We'd have to have a massive program to ensure that every adult resident in the UK was on the database. And then you've got the problems of immigration in the sense that people would be coming into the jurisdiction and aggressing the jurisdiction all the time. So you'd have tourists coming in. You might have people working from other jurisdictions. You might have people coming in from, to work, emigrating into the country. And how you would practically manage a whole nation database is even if we wanted to, I would have severe doubts whether it was even doable from a practical point of view. Now, I know when I was consulting and doing work for the Middle East, they were certainly considering whole population databases in the Middle East, but I think they pretty well abandoned the idea because the practicalities of it just don't make sense, let alone the cost. I mean, the costs are going to be eye-watering. So I think we need to remove or rid ourselves of the idea that there'll ever be a situation when everybody is on. I don't think it's a proportional response for law enforcement to just have everybody in a DNA database. What is proportional is to have people who have offended and have been proven to have offended on that database.
Thank you.
Let's move on to another case where it illustrates the rapid changes and evolution of the use of DNA, and that's the case of Coletta Ram. She was murdered in October 1983, so it was actually before the Pitchfork murders, but the use of DNA in this case was not until 25 years later. Colette was raped and strangled in Keyworth in Nottinghamshire while walking to her boyfriend's house. The police immediately launched a murder inquiry but could not find the killer, despite the case being the first to feature on the BBC's Crime Watch the following year. Then, some 25 years later, it came across Tim's desk at the FSS. Tim, do you want to take up the story there? What were you asked to do and what do you first remember about it?
Yeah, so I'll try to put it in context. So when this case first happened, it was pre-DNA era. So a lot of cases that happened prior to 1990 had never had any DNA done on them. Only a small fraction of cases ever got done on the RFLP technique, those with the largest amount of DNA. And so there's a whole raft of murders and sexual offences that occurred prior to 1990 that had never really had the level of DNA applied to them that would be applied now. So Colette, it was called Operation Odyssey. Operation Odyssey was a cold case. In the original investigation, nobody had been arrested or charged. So the difference when it came across my desk was that was three things. The first one, the national DNA database had kicked up in 1995, and so now there was a possibility that if you could raise a DNA profile, you could proactively search it against the national DNA database. So the next thing that had happened is that as part of a project that I was involved in, run by one of my colleagues called Kathy Turner, who subsequently got the OBE for her work, she developed what's called a cold case program within the Forensic Science Service. And what we'd done is we realised that over the years that forensic scientists working at the FSA had become magpies. And we realised that we had a repository which contained material, what we call retained material, going back to the 60s of old cases. And this was, even though the police might have destroyed every exhibit in the case and no longer kept it. We had the ability to do proactive DNA search, and we'd got this massive, massive repository of retained material that we could access. And the third thing was there'd been a new innovation such that the technique that we brought out in 1995, in 2000, we figured out a way to increase the sensitivity of that technique so that we could isolate and test even the lowest amounts of DNA. So when you put those three together, the toolbox in the year 2000 was huge compared to any time previously in history. And so at that time, I was part of the cold case unit, and Claire Aram dropped to my desk. It was, and it sounds terrible, I know, just another cold case at that time. We were doing hundreds of them, and Colette was just another one. Operation Odyssey was just another one. And as I read the file, I realised that there were some opportunities. And then the other big thing for the Operation Odyssey case was that you had a senior investigating officer, Superintendent Kevin Flynn, who was very pro-science. He was keen to try things. We tried lots of new things in that case that ultimately led us to the killer, but it was that commitment to do that, because it would have been easy to walk away and say, oh, we've tried our best, we'll call it a day, because he had to find, without putting too fine a point in it, a lot of money to try things that had never been tried before.
So as I understand it, you did not, in your initial sweep of DNA, find anybody that matched. Is that right?
That's right. So the first thing I tried was we tried a microscope slide. So these are slides that are made to diagnose the presence of semen. And so in our archive, I found a microscope slide from the original case, and I got what we call a partial profile. In other words, it wasn't a complete DNA profile, and it was partial, but it was too partial to search on the National DNA database. It would have generated too many what we call adventitious matches, or chaff, perhaps is another way of doing it. So that was the first sweep, but we were able to use it as an elimination tool, and we were able to eliminate lots of people who were, you know, were suspects at the time or whatever, but we didn't have anything that we could proactively search. A lot of people would have left it at that, but Kevin Flynn wanted to go further. And in that case, there was a story, which I have to say I was very, very sceptical about, of a pub landlady at a pub called the Generous Briton, who said that on the night in question, when the police were doing their inquiries, a guy had walked into the pub and she saw blood on his hands. He saw her look at his hands. He disappeared into the loo and washed his hands, came out, had a sandwich, a drink of orange, and then disappeared off. And to their eternal credit, Nottinghamshire Police had attended, and the officer had gone into the toilets to find just one paper towel in a bin, picked it up and bagged it and tagged it and brought it back to the Nick. Kevin said, well, we've got this paper towel. We think it might be linked. And I thought, oh, well, there's no chance. But anyway, he insisted I did it. So I looked at it and I thought, well, I can't test a whole paper towel. So I had a game of almost what you call battleships with it. So you remember the game of battleships where you just pick a square? So I divided the whole paper towel into 1 centimetre squares, and I got essentially gridded them off from 1 to 50, A to Z, and I just picked some numbers and cut out 1 centimetre squares from this paper towel. And the theory was, if the guy had washed his hands and then dried his hands, his DNA could be effectively smeared all over this paper towel. And several of those 1 centimetre squares showed a mixture of DNA, part of which matched Colette Arama. I had Colette's profile from some of her personal effects from back in the day that had been kept. And I could see that not only was it mixed in with a man, but this man matched the partial profile that I'd seen on the microscope slide previously. And by subtracting Colette's profile from those mixtures, I was able to basically realise the full DNA profile of a man who appeared to be the source also of the semen at the scene. So obviously this was met with huge and great excitement. And so the same day, Kevin asked me to search the national database. So I uploaded it and searched the national DNA database. And then we unfortunately got the terribly disappointing news that it had not hit any other profile on the DNA database. And so although we were there sat now in possession of the DNA profile of Colette's killer, we sadly didn't know who he was. And at that stage, the case could have stalled. But Kevin also wanted to try another tack, and this idea was that, well, we know that DNA from relatives is very similar. So I have a brother. So me and my brother, we don't have the same DNA profile, but our DNA profiles are very, very similar to each other. And so we thought, well, what happens if we search the database, but we don't look for an exact match because we know there isn't one. But what happens if we look for people who were a near match, people who were very similar? And so this was the concept of what's now become familial DNA or familial searching. So at that time, we used a new technique called genetic prioritization and geographic prioritization. So with the list, what we were able to do is prioritize people on how we developed a measure of how similar they were, what's called a likelihood ratio. So we could rank everybody on the list from the highest genetic similarity to the lowest genetic similarity. So we could order the list. And then Kevin would overlay it with geography and other information. And the idea would be, we thought the guys locally must be probably from the Nottinghamshire area. We also had a description which told us he was Caucasian. So we obviously prioritised Caucasian people. And we knew roughly what age he ought to be when he offended. It was 1983, and he must have been driving. So he's probably more than a teenager. And so we could guess his probable age as well. So using those criteria, we filtered down these lists to really prioritize people. And we ended up with a list of about 200, 250 people. Kevin's team went to see all these people one by one. All 200 and odd people, families were completely exonerated. That took over 6 months' work and cost eye-watering amount of money. But at the end of it, we had nothing to show for it. No idea. So here we were now, several years on, and so we were almost resigned to the fact that we'd given it the best possible go we could. And so I recall we had a kind of, I wouldn't say a wash-up, but almost a wash-up meeting in Nottinghamshire Police Headquarters at West Bridgford, and we had biscuits and tea, and it had a kind of feeling of finality about it. And we were going around the table, and Kevin was saying, you know, is there anything else we can do? Anybody, any ideas, any more ideas? No. And he got to me, and I remember saying at the time, I said, well, it has taken us over 12 months to do all this work since we did the first familial search. I guess there's a formal possibility that while we've been beavering away, eliminating all these people, that a relative of the offender might come on the database in that 12 months. I've never known it happen. I think it's a long shot, but why don't we just redo the search again and compare the new list with the old list? So he left and he said, let's do that. Let's go that. Kevin used to call it pushing the button. I'll push that button. Yeah, go away and do it. So I went back and we ran it, and we sent the results to Kevin, and he phoned me up and he says, you're never going to believe this. Right in top of the list, number one parent-child list, there's a guy, a young guy, come on from Nottinghamshire, not only from Nottinghamshire, but from the Keyworth area. And I said, you're joking. He went, no. So he says, we've looked at him, and he's obviously can't, he's not the offender, but he's got his dad, and his dad's one of four siblings. In other words, he's got three uncles and his dad, but one of them's just died. And he says, well, which one's it going to be, Tim? And I went, well, I don't know. I said, it could be any of the four of them. I said, the only way we'll know is if you're going to have to arrest them all and then take samples. So obviously the two living brothers and the father of the man on the who'd come on for a very minor traffic offence were tested. Anyway, the samples were coercively taken, as you have the power to do under PACE, and they were rushed to the lab. And then we did, as Cass did, one of those urgent real-time turnarounds within 12 hours. And this man's father matched, but the two brothers were eliminated. And this turned out to be a chap by the name of Hutchinson. He had been seen during the original inquiry, but he said he was in a hospital having a cancer operation at the time. And he'd provided that alibi, and unfortunately that alibi hadn't been run all the way to ground, and so he was eliminated from the inquiry.
It is an extraordinary story. It is an extraordinary story, and he went on to plead guilty. So it was an amazing use of familial DNA.
Well, he did plead
and
guilty.
Great credit.
Yeah, he did plead guilty, but there is another little twist that before he pleaded guilty, he blamed his deceased brother. And so, again, Kevin, Superintendent Flynn, ever the resourceful, went and found out where the brother had been treated at hospital, and he found out they'd retained a hospital biopsy sample from him. And Kevin brought to me that, and he says, I've got this hospital biopsy sample. Can you raise a DNA profile from it? And I said, well, I can certainly try. And that was successful, so I was able to do it. So we were able to then conclusively prove that the deceased fourth brother was not that. And I think it was only after that work had been done that he eventually pled guilty.
Amazing, amazing.
Tim, just a matter of interest, in the present sort of day, what primarily is mostly coming up for DNA testing, sort of case-wise?
Well, you've hit on a thorny issue there, Cass, which is forensic budgets are limited, okay? So you cannot just carry out DNA on everything you'd want to, okay? And so every force has a forensic submissions department whose job it is to triage what comes through. If you allowed every officer to submit every sample they wanted to do, the force would be bust within a very short period of time. So obviously, the more serious the case, the more likely it is that DNA profiling is going to be used. So you know, you're going to see it in all your homicides, all your serious assaults, all your serious sexual offences. if there's residual budget after that, then you can start about thinking applying your DNA to what we call more volume crime cases. And so there is now, when most forces have a volume crime program, so we are routinely testing samples recovered from burglaries, from thefts of motor vehicles and other acquisitive crime. But the serious offences are the ones that are prioritised, obviously, from a budget point of view. And there's, generally speaking, no real constraint on them. In other words, there's no stone left unturned in a serious rape or a serious homicide. But on volume crime, you've got to cut your cloth according to what you can afford.
Tim, can I just ask you to kind of... I'm still a tiny bit confused about genomics and in relation to present-day investigations.
Okay, so by the difference between genetics and genomics, the forensic tests we've used to date, which all the national databases are built around, have used a very small panel of markers from the genome, effectively about 16, 17 markers. In the genomics era, we actually can sequence the whole of the DNA. Okay, and it is now possible with the advances to do forensic grade sequencing and interrogate hundreds of thousands of markers in the genome, okay, rather than just a few dozen, which is where forensic tests have always been. And that's the difference from genetics, looking at a few genetic sites, to genomics, looking at the whole genome. And once you can look at the whole genome, that's a rich source of DNA. And so now the forensic techniques have got good enough that we can produce genomic grade information from forensic grade samples. And that's where a lot of the current research is going into predicting people's facial characteristics, height, skin colours, biogeographical ancestry. We can sequence their mitochondrial DNA so that we can look at the maternal line. We can do tens of thousands of markers across the genome and look at lots of different things. So the information content is massive. So to give you an idea of how big a technology change that is, it took nearly 10 years and billions of pounds to sequence one person's DNA in entirety, what's called the Human Genome Project. I can send a sample away to a lab in America and have that entire genome, my entire genome sequenced for $1,000, and that's the technology leap that's gone on into genomics. So the next era of forensic DNA is going to be the era of forensic genomics.
Wow, that is just incredible. Just, I mean, sadly, that's all we've got time for. I mean, we could keep talking forever, but it feels a bit like we should have you back next year just to sort of check in on this because it's moving so fast. Is that the sort of pace of change, Tim, out of interest? Is it every year something more is going to be happening in this area?
Yes, I think maybe not every year, but certainly every 5 to 10 years. So I'm working on a number of things with colleagues now, which are, as is the national, as is national research and all over the world. But yeah, there are exciting developments afoot. Some of them have already happened. We haven't got time to go into it today, but I could tell you about some cases now where forensic genomics have solved cases that have been intractable for 30, 40 years, principally in the US. And I also could go into why there's a big furore about this now, because now you're entering genomics, you're entering into real difficult ethical and legal territory as well. So this isn't uncontroversial, this development. So if we have time, there's not only the application of it, but there's also the ethical and other dimensions to it as well, about whether it's we should allow forensic scientists to be able to access this level of information.
Well, sadly, we don't this time, but we will be back in season 4. And I think genomics is going to be there because it is the cutting edge. Absolutely. So we've covered a lot of ground here from Alec Jeffries and the mid-80s and mass screening through to genomics. It's an extraordinary journey. And thank you for sharing it with us, Dr. Tim Clayton. Thank you, Linda Kaz, as well. It's been another brilliant episode. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with episode 5, which is on fibres and the case of Operation Airlines, the IRA plot to blow up power stations around London. Until then, make sure to subscribe to the series wherever you're listening now so you don't miss an episode. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please give us a nice rating too. And if you want to know more about the podcast and Linda's books, check out her website at lindalaplante.com. Her new novel, Vanished, is out on the 31st of March in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. Until next week, thanks for listening.